Jill Lepore is a professor of American history at Harvard University and a staff writer at The New Yorker. A two-time Pulitzer Prize finalist, her many books include the international bestseller These Truths and If Then, both longlisted for the National Book Award. Last night, she was in Manchester Center, Vermont, for a Vermont Digger event entitled Democracy, News, and History, Unprecedented Times. She spoke about the importance of local journalism, its impact on our communities, and the role it plays in preserving democracy. I spoke with her at the Manchester Community Library about journalism, democracy, and her latest book, just out in paperback, The Deadline. We welcome Jill Lepore to the roundtable.
Jill Lepore, what a great pleasure. Thank you very much for taking the time out.
Oh, thanks so much for having me.
The new book, just out in paperback, is called The Deadline. It's a collection of essays, but there is a theme here, isn't there?
Yeah, I mean, I went through everything I'd written over the last just few years, really, almost maybe thinking about the Trump era, and sorted things out. You know, there's this bunch of essays about the pandemic, a bunch of essays about our politics, and then there are a series of groupings of essays that are more personal. And the book's kind of about the relationship between those two things. How do we navigate our lives through difficult historical times?
Why is it so tough, number one? Number two, it would seem that through history we would have learned lessons along the way to help calibrate us better for difficult political times.
I love the idea of that. I don't think that's true. I recognize people believe that. I think there's a lot of solace to be had in history in realizing that our times are not unprecedented, that much that we consider to be especially difficult or challenging now, it's just really weird historical time. You could find other moments in time that bear some similarities. But I don't know that there are really, I don't think there's really a way to steer clear of what are some sort of basic problems with human nature.
Is there an extreme that we're seeing now?
I was recently thinking about this, the sort of odd turn in the Democratic National Committee's decision to celebrate joy, having spent some years really committed to what I think of as a philosophy of doom. I don't think most people can really turn on a dime in that way and kind of go from, oh my God, climate change, oh my God, Trumpism, oh, you know, oh my gosh, the AI onslaught, and kind of turn that on its heels. There's a lot of doomism in our culture broadly, but I'm not sure there is that much doom.
So define that. Help me with the lack of doom, because I like that. I want to believe that. So how do we get through not thinking there is doom? Because often when I watch the news or listen to NPR, there's a lot of doom.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's kind of a gesture. It's a cultural gesture in, you know, maybe in the cultural water that a lot of people are swimming in right now or have been. I wrote a piece some years ago that's in this collection that was called No, We Cannot, that sort of about the fashionability of radical pessimism is a response to the end of the Obama era. That what Obama was really trying to do in his campaign was, and actually this is why, among the reasons progressives like to call themselves progressives as opposed to liberals, they're trying to revive some notion of progress, that history moves forward in time, that there's no going back, that we sort of, that the arc of history bends toward justice, but also that technological progress will also take us to a better world, to kind of really embrace the sense of radical possibility was a thing that Obama was trying to do. And I think in some considerable ways did. But when his administration came to an end, when he was replaced by Trump, there really was this kind of like rush of no, we cannotism. And radical pessimism became really pervasive across the culture. Like people just would talk about things in those kinds of terms. So if you think about, like, even just think back to like the year 2000, I remember when I was writing my History of the United States, I spent a lot of time with the year 2000 and the kind of technological utopianism that animated American culture in those years. I remember Wired magazine, when it launched, like, this big issue about how, you know, the wiring up of the internet will make all the world's peoples into one people, and all regionalism and racism and distinctions of national origin or national boundaries or religion, all these distinctions would immediately end, and we would, you know, live in this harmonious future together. Which is exactly what people said about the telegraph when it was sent across the Atlantic in the underground cable. It's just like, there's just, like, technology does not save us. So I think that part of the reason that we have this kind of roller coaster between optimism and pessimism is there's a lot of utopianism in the culture. And this was what my piece, No You Cannot, was really about. It's like, utopianism will always be answered by dystopianism. Because a utopian society is a planned society which actually brings mainly misery. It can never be achieved. So it's just a kind of, it's a little bit like the hormonal volatility of a teenager.
Right. Okay. So, but when you look at going from Obama to Trump, it is, and you're describing that as a roller coaster, which I certainly understand, but is it also a backlash? Is it a term of, this is what we had been going for, this is how we've been running, operating, sailing for 8 years, and now, okay, enough?
I tend to be a little resistant of backlash narratives because I think that Obama did not accomplish what his administration needed to accomplish to address the real suffering of Americans who'd been left behind by technological change principally, but also globalization, right? Like, this is the problem with progressives, right? That, you know, the kind of beginning with the kind of 1970s embrace of the knowledge worker, Gary Hart, sort of Atari Democrats, down through Clinton and Gore, and, you know, the kind of tech world obeisance, that Obama participated in that and, you know, kind of continued to celebrate and hype up the great the wonders of globalization, and just didn't really address what that meant, especially for rural parts of the country, especially for people without a college education, what the consequences were of those kinds of disruptions of American life and the American industry and American economy. So is it a backlash if the people that didn't want to vote for you are unhappy that you didn't actually address the things that were the political demands they had in the first place? I don't think so. I think there's quite a bit more continuity there than backlash.
So if it's not a backlash, then what were voters looking for with Trump, and ultimately did they get it?
No, they absolutely didn't get it. That's part of the story of where we're at now, right? So if you think about those voters who there were, you know, there's the Obama-Trump voter, right? A lot of people who thought, okay, my life's been really hard. There's, you know, manufacturing in my state has disappeared. It's impossible for my children to buy a house. You know, I am really suffering from injuries and long-term consequences with my military service, and yet I'm not really getting the benefits that I need. And I also feel like the Democratic Party, as the party of labor, kind of hates me and still hates me. And the sort of the Clinton deplorables moment that I think spoke volumes to those people. And then they expected, okay, well, I'll vote for Trump. We'll see what he brings. He at least knows I'm having a really hard time, seems to recognize people like me having a hard time. He didn't deliver anything to those people. So I guess I still don't think that falls into a backlash narrative, right? That's a kind of, that is an explanation of the growing strength of populism on the left as well. I mean, this was a huge part of the appeal of Bernie Sanders in 2016.
When you look at, you were talking about the joy, and I understand your concern with looking at that, but that, like, turned on a dime because it seemed, it isn't that, and I'm not over, I hope I'm not oversimplifying it, but you had a candidate that many Democrats thought was most definitely going to lose, and now you got a shot at the game. Is it as simple as that?
Yeah, I mean, but I should say, like, I'm just really not a great sideline commentator of the football game. Like, I'm a historian. I have, like, the long view of these political arrangements. And so I like to, how do I understand Harris's current appeal and the rhetorical devices that she and Tim Walz are deploying, and are they effective or not effective? I'm not the ace commentator on that stuff. Like, the day-by-day play is really not me.
Fair enough. So let me ask, I love when historians say that to me. Cause it's so cool. Cause it's that, I, like that, that will come to you, right? I mean, that will, there will be a time.
The idea is that one day you would be able to see. I mean, there's this great book, The Landscape of History, that has this beautiful image on the cover of a guy standing, this famous painting, guy standing on the top of a mountain looking down across a valley. And it's like, you have to be on top of the mountain to look down in the valley. And we're all in the valley right now. Like, I don't care what historian you talk to. They can come up with some theory about where we are and where we're going next, but they don't know. We're all in the valley. And, you know, when somebody gets up to the mountain and can look back and see the valley, no one's going to say, oh, those people in the valley were wrong 10 years ago. Like, no one ever gets called on their punditry is just completely wrong. It just floats away.
The name of the book is The Deadline. You are here in Manchester Center, Vermont, to talk to a group, and Vermont Digger is presenting this, and you're having a discussion about journalism. And I'm curious as to your thoughts. You are a journalist, but that's a term that you can't fully embrace, right, as a historian.
Well, I think investigative journalism is one of the most important things, the kinds of work that's done in this country and around the world. And I think it's a really, really hard and often very dangerous work and requires just a real commitment to the public weal. And I have nothing but respect for that work. I sometimes work as a journalist in that I report pieces in addition to my usual thing, which I'm more usually doing work in an archive and offering up a historical account of something that might cast light on a present day question or problem. So I don't think it's like I'm a writer. I'm mostly a writer. And I'm a professor of history. But when I first started reporting pieces, because I write for The New Yorker, I called all my journalist friends and I was like, I need like kind of like the quick education in how do journalists do what they do? Like, what are the ethics of journalism? And I got so actually really interested in that because journalists have quite different rules of evidence than historians do. And they're different than, say, the rules of evidence in scientific research. And they're different than the law of evidence and the law. And I started teaching a course called The History of Evidence that compares the rules of evidence in these different realms. Because actually, it's really, really interesting to me what counts as evidence for a journalist and what is inadmissible is really different than it is in other realms. And it's really important to be acquainted with that. And one of the reasons that I think an institution like the Vermont Digger is so important is it's a really serious journalistic effort. You know, they're not answering to corporate investors. They're not, you know, their story choices are not determined by an algorithm. They're really doing serious, important journalism at a time when there's not very much of that. And they're answerable to really kind of old school journalistic ethics, and those really still matter.
Do you still, you find yourself adhering to those ethics, though, even if you're reporting for The New Yorker?
Oh, yeah, yeah. No, I think about them all the time. And, you know, The New Yorker's a magazine that has its storied fact-checking department, and there's a great exertion of editorial judgment. And, I mean, I think the role of editorial judgment is a hugely important one. It's for your radio station, like for any news organization that I care about. And I think these have been really quite challenging times for a lot of editorial boards and editors. I think there's a kind of, you know, people talk about the Trump derangement syndrome with news organizations kind of losing their ability to think clearly about how do they cover this particular candidate or how do they cover this particular historical moment. And I think people tend to kind of hide behind a curtain of like, well, it's unprecedented. We have to make unprecedented decisions. And I don't buy that. I actually think the long established rules about anonymous sources and verification and corroboration and fairness really, really matter, and they matter more in challenging political times.
And will there be an audience that will be able to financially support it so it can continue?
Yeah, that's much, much, much harder to say.
My understanding is you had a family paper route.
Yeah, we delivered, we all of us delivered. I guess my mother got to sleep in. We delivered the Sunday paper, the Worcester Telegram was the Telegram and Gazette in the 70s when we did it. My dad would drive us. It was a long, in fairness, it was a very long route. And also, my dad had been a newspaper boy when he was a kid, and he loved the whole idea of it. So he would drive the station wagon, and the four of us would line up on the tailgate. The back of the station wagon would be filled with stacks of papers, and he would drive like 1 mile an hour all through the town, and we would hop on, hop off, hop on, off on. He'd call out the names, and my dad would be smoking his pipe in the front seat. And he would shout like, "O'Brien, on the left," you know. And then you had to collect the money, and we had like a tobacco tin in the back seat. They were supposed to throw the money into. It was like the best Sunday morning ever.
And it is, it's different now, but I think for a lot of us who grew up in very similar circumstances as far as what the paper, either delivering the paper or what the paper meant to us when it was delivered, that it is different, but we can still have that rush when we see a story that speaks to us on that Sunday morning.
Yeah, it's still a rush to open up the paper in the morning. I think maybe it's a little bit more of a dopamine rush in a way now that's different. And, you know, we forget the huge, huge change early on, even before social media and the kind of destruction of the business model of newspapers, was going from the paper to the story. That's what digitization meant. And so suddenly people didn't quite have like, oh, I subscribe to the Worcester Telegram. It's like, did you see that story about the polar bear at the Springfield Zoo? And it's like, but you don't even know who reported that, where it originally appeared, who edited it. Like that shrinking of the unit of news from the newspaper to the news story. Well, it's really exciting, and there's a lot of great that came out of that. But it's a part of what happened to the business model.
I'm going to turn that just a little bit as my final question to you, though. Above us in the Manchester Library, there are hundreds of people waiting to hear you speak, and they're here to hear you, and that's part of it too, right? I mean, it's how you convey the message. It's the trust they have in you as a historian, as a journalist.
Well, it's my favorite thing is to speak at a public library. These buildings are kind of sacred to me in this deep way. So even just coming down the stairs, entering this building, and there's a sign, I guess Special Collections is down here, and the Historical Society has offices down here. And in the town where I grew up, the Historical Society has a special archives room in the basement. And I went there last year for the final episode of my podcast, The Last Archive, and I found on the wall a framed document that was a thank you note to the donor of the library. It was partly like a Carnegie library, but it was also privately funded. And it was this beautiful note about how our children and our children's children will always have this place as the place to go to find out what's true and what needs to be known. And, you know, I just shudder. It gave me chills. It was the most beautiful thing to kind of come across at this thing that kind of, you know, hidden in this room that no one even bothers to go into anymore, but that was just this beautiful statement of gratitude for what public institutions like newspapers, like public libraries, like public schools, public parks, what these mean to us in such brutally privatized times.
The latest book is The Deadline. It is out in paperback. Jill Lepore, a great pleasure to have you and to see you. Thank you so much for doing this. I greatly appreciate it.
Thank you so much, and thanks for public radio.
Jill Lepore is a professor of American history at Harvard University and a staff writer at The New Yorker. Her latest book is The Deadline, Essays, now out in paperback. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.